Hello, everyone. This is From the Field with Tanner. Today's episode is called Shapes. It's a conversation with Dr. Alex Gamarino about what shaped her path into counseling. It's a story about compassion, systems, and the challenges of returning to school, society, and yourself.
So I've been here for 4 years, but this is my first year as a faculty member and as the clinic director for the VAC clinic. So I graduated from the doctoral program in counseling and educational development, and then kind of just came straight through and was hired on as clinic director and faculty member. So that was a really great experience.
Is that luck or skill?
I think a little bit of both, and I would throw in timing. Timing was a key factor in that as well.
Dr. C, as her students like to call her, didn't begin her story with counseling. It started somewhere else, in scrubs, not a therapy room. And as you'll hear, with the kind of clarity that can only come from hating a course that you really needed to pass, she pivoted into a space to which she belongs. The VAC thing is really cool that they do here.
Yeah.
Can you tell a little more about that?
So we are just one of the mental health resources offered on campus. People tend to get us confused with the larger counseling center, which is CAPS, and we are not CAPS. And they are the primary mental health resource on campus. But what's unique about us is that all of our counselors are graduate students, so either master's level or doctoral level. And if they're master's level, they're counselors in training, but they all see clients at the clinic, and we offer free to low-cost services for UNCG members, so students, faculty, and staff, but also to community members. So that's a really nice thing that we are able to provide, because our mission is to make sure that mental health is accessible to people. And because we can't take insurance, we keep our costs pretty much the same of what you would pay as a copay in your insurance. So
wow, that's cool. Yeah. I know there's some other foundations in Greensboro that do the public side of that, folks that can't afford it, but the student side is huge.
Yep.
I know, you know, I think it's 8% of college students are facing homelessness, and you know, that leads to a lot of, just issues are just trickling everywhere that get there and precede it. But that's just a huge number. I always think about whenever the need on college campus, you know, it's not being met in a big way. So I love that. And so the CAPS, how's that different again? So what do they do? Do they do counseling as well, or?
Yeah. So okay. CAPS is the primary, or Counseling and Psychological Services is the primary mental health resource on campus. They are able to see students at no cost. So that's the really nice part about it. And they're also in the student health building, Gov Student Health. And so what's really great about that is they're so well connected that if it was something where maybe you had a diagnosis and you needed some medication management, they could refer you downstairs and you could go see one of the clinicians downstairs. Oh, wow. For that. So they're also a really great resource, and they do lots of groups. They also will table events like the VAC clinic does. And so it's just, again, I think it's the more mental health resources we can get on campus, the better, both for the campus community, but also the local community, because you also have the psychology clinic on campus, too. So there's a lot of us right now.
Fighting for attention.
Well, I would say we work more just like hand in hand with each other a lot and lean on each other, because I think that's one of the big aspects in the mental health field as a whole, is being able to lean and consult with other clinicians and professionals on campus. So, we love to work with both CAPS and the psychology clinics. So.
Yeah, that's clearly a big thing. It makes me wonder, if the colleges are picking up that we have to get ahead of these issues and address them directly and find affordable ways to do it. Yeah. And we've got an extensive amount of resources on campus. Obviously, we can't extend that into the community because of cost. And there are others who are trying to extend in the community, and that's great. But how, staying out of politics, because I know we're not allowed to go there. But what is your thoughts on maybe not a universal health care, but a universal mental health care? Do you think that's close? Is that approachable?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that's happening in the mental health field as a whole that we're having to navigate as professionals. I think one is obviously, as much as we try to reduce the stigma is still very much prevalent in some communities. And so further giving psychoeducation, but also I think a lot of what our department, CED, has done is that we've taken more of a stance on how can we work with communities and not for communities. Like, how can we include our local community members in the process of making changes to the clinic or identifying how we can make things more accessible. So, for example, we do lots of partnerships with organizations on campus and in the community. And one of the things we did this year was we made a partnership with Integrative Community Studies on campus, which are it's a really wonderful program for students who have intellectual or developmental disabilities. And that was really great because it also gave our counselors extensive training on not just how to work with students who may have IDD, but also students who are just neurodiverse in general, and how to navigate maybe assessments and having to be flexible in items we're asking for, but also ways that we can alter policies and procedures. I think of another thing that we did was our old front desk was not the most accessible feature we had in the clinic. It left very little room for clients to actually walk past it. And so we got a new front desk that is way more accessible and allows especially our clients who require the use of a wheelchair and things like that to be able to come and actually move around in the clinic. So I think, you know, we're trying to be as accessible as we can without like overdoing it. But again, I think that's coming from a standpoint of working with people, not for people, and making assumptions on what we know best, and also trying to reduce the stigma, because I think it's going to be prevalent. We just have to let people know that it's okay to come and talk to someone, and that it's a brave thing to do is to seek counseling. So,
yeah, that's awesome. And that little word change of, you know, work with and not for, is such a powerful thing. It reminds me of ask what, not why, whenever you're trying to be self-aware. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's awesome.
Her time volunteering at a crisis center became the turning point. It wasn't just the intensity of the calls. It was the quiet moments, too. The people who just needed to be heard. The ones calling in, barely holding it together. She wasn't getting paid. There were no grades. But there was something deeper. A sense that she could stay calm in the chaos, and that maybe that mattered more than any medical degree ever would. When you're the person people turn to on their worst day, and you still want to show up again the next day, that's when you know.
It was, I think, when I hit organic chemistry, that was a like a sign, maybe this is not what I want to go into. But I remember in undergrad changing my major to psychology because I really enjoyed my intro to psych class that I had. The professor I had at East Carolina University, he was amazing. And he really got me intrigued about the field and mental health as a whole. And so it just felt like a natural and comfortable place to transition if I wasn't going to be going the medical route. And so that was kind of the starting point for it. And then I think what really pushed me towards counseling specifically was also while I was in undergrad, I volunteered at a crisis center in Greenville. And that, I think, was a life-changing experience for sure. Knowing one, I wasn't getting paid for it, and it was just something I volunteered to do. And watching and learning crisis management, I think, is a skill everyone should have. Because nowadays it helps me. Like, normally if there's chaos going on or if a crisis is happening, I am the calm person. I'm the calm, collected one. I know how to navigate things. But that was a really interesting experience because we were answering calls for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We were taking walk-ins with people who had mental health diagnoses, and it was a part of their routine treatment planning to come to the center and talk with someone every week. We had victim advocates who would go out for to the hospitals for people who unfortunately experienced sexual assault, and were able to walk them through their rights and the options they have, essentially, and work alongside law enforcement while doing that. So it was a pretty like, it was a variety of things we did, and it was just, again, it was really life-changing being able to have an impact in people's lives in some shape or form, because by the time we were interacting with some of these people, they were at some of the lowest points of their life. And so being able to, in a way, just have be another support person for them, I think was really beneficial. It definitely, I tell people all the time, when I worked as a crisis counselor, the good days outweighed the bad. Because there is, if you look at any crisis center, anyone who is engaging in crisis management services, there is a high turnover rate. And it makes sense why, because again, like, we are seeing things that people are at some of the lowest points of their lives. They're on the verge
literally,
of,
I'm yeah, sure like wanting, calling you yeah. saying, you are my last stop, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And I think, and part of that is, you know, there were days we had some really tough situations that we had to deal with, and not knowing what exactly happened once the phone hung up or once we didn't see them again.
That would be so hard.
Yeah. And so,
there's no connection. So you have no connection from the point that you hang up. There's no way to track them or see what's going on.
No, if you're working for any center that has the lifeline, or the hotline for all of that, you are taking calls from all over the country. Oh, so wow. I even remember a situation where, because we also provided resources too. And I remember a situation where we had a caller once who was unhoused, and he was looking for a nearby shelter. And I had to pull up Google Maps because this was in like New York, and I have no sense of direction for New York.
Who does?
No. And having to pull up Google Maps and find a shelter that was near where he was calling from and guide, like, give him directions on how to get there. It was, but there were other stories too, where we really got to help people in those moments, and people would give feedback and tell us, you know, like, this is why I called. I just needed to hear it from someone else. I needed someone to tell me that, it was going to be okay, and that they appreciate that I'm here, and that, you know, I have resources and support if I need it. So I think those moments made me feel just, again, like, you're helping someone with their life. You're another person of support.
Yeah. And just to relate to that, isn't it? It's kind of incredible to think, like, everybody has that moment where, like, I need you to tell me I'm okay, or, like, I need this from you. Mm-hmm. And you've got people out there that don't have that in any shape or form. Mm-hmm. And they've been needing that for years. And then their last stop is to call a stranger and say, please just tell me, mm-hmm. you know, that's such a big deal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't give credit to that. You're walking around, you're standing behind that person at a gas station. Mm-hmm. I mean, they exist everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're feeling what you feel, and not that theirs are more extreme or anything, but they may have been feeling it longer. Mm-hmm. And that itself is a lot of weight.
Yeah. And people, I think, sometimes just need someone to listen to them. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people lose a lot of autonomy in different, you know, positions, different power roles and things like that. And a lot of times when we would get those calls or we would talk to people in person, it was just, I needed just to come and talk to someone and for the other person not to say anything or give their opinion, but just listen to me for once.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Just is, like, I'm sitting here thinking about it just like while you're talking, and like, I mean, and I knew it existed. I know not a lot, but I know a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. And then just hearing someone that has experienced it talk about it is just like, that is so heavy. That is so much.
Yeah.
So you took that and you move forward. You're like, this is the path I want to be, because ew to biology, and that's what happened, right? So we're landing.
Yeah, it was. Oh wow, this is going to be a lot. I give all the credit to people who go through medical school, mm-hmm. and who major in biology and the sciences and
I have,
really excel at it.
Yeah, my wife's cousin's husband, kind of long, but we see them a lot. He is a surgeon, ER surgeon, and you talk to him and it's like a different world. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just him, because he's the only ER surgeon I know, if I'm being honest. I'm not, you know, I don't roll with a bunch of doctors, but But talking to him, I'm like, there's something else going on here that you went through in school that the rest of us did not experience.
Yeah.
it's wild. You can see it, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so we said OODA biology. We moved on.
Yeah. And then when I was working at the crisis center, they actually asked me to stay on for a position when I was nearing towards the end of graduation. And at that time, I had thought about it, but I knew that if I really wanted to pursue counseling, that I was probably going to have to go to grad school and get my master's. And so ultimately, I chose to go get my master's. But I was at that center for a year, which
wow.
is not often that you see in crisis counseling. And it was something that, too, I like took on leadership roles within that. So working in like committees and setting up outreach with community organizations so we could learn more about what they offered and be able to provide that to other people.
So that's been a big part of your path is like committee leadership,
yeah.
being involved. It's more than just the hour sessions. It's, you know, what happens on the outside of that for you.
Oh, yeah. I think for me, I love the hands-on application pieces to my job like that. I love being involved in the community. I love being able to go to events and engage with people. I don't know that I would call myself fully extroverted, but I just enjoy communicating and being able to connect with other people. And so the hands-on aspect has been something that I've always done throughout my life. Like, I've always been a part of community resources and engaging in some way. I am not someone who could sit in an office all day, 9 to 5. A corporate job would be my worst nightmare, essentially.
I've done it, and it is your worst nightmare.
Yeah.
I'm extroverted to the point where I'm good until I get to my car. And then it's like, I become a different person in that moment.
It's even so many people are like that now that they say it's ambiverts, right? Where it's you can be both extroverted and introverted just in different aspects or things that are going on in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say stop putting labels on me.
Yeah. I am me. And I will do what I want.
She was laying a foundation, but the strength of that foundation was about to be tested in a school with a student in a system that wasn't ready.
What would be one experience that would say, this is it?
I think for me, that actually came later on in my master's
program. I got my master's at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
So lucky you
said that. They have a great program there. Yeah, I liked Knoxville. It was a good place to live, too. Mm-hmm. And I did their dual track option, which is how I got the experience in both clinical mental health and school counseling and how I was eligible to get licensure in both.
Wow.
But I remember specifically in my school counseling experience, I remember doing my internship for the master's program. Because you had to do two since you were doing both school and clinical. And in my school counseling internship, I remember working with a student who he just had a lot going on in his life. He identified as queer, which was another added layer to what we were allowed to do in the school system as a counselor and what we weren't allowed to do. I don't know if you know anything about Tennessee laws, but they're a little bit more strict around some of those aspects. And it's not something where we could have had like an LGBTQ plus group, essentially. You would have had to name it something else. But
you're allowed to have conversations with individuals based on what they're feeling.
At that time, yes. I don't know how much the laws have changed since then, but at that time, yes. And so he was going through a lot. He was experiencing some suicidal ideations and just really having a hard time both navigating school and home life and all of the things, because I think there were a lot of cultural elements in it as well. And I just remember having just a really intense session one day, and then it kind of came up of like, I think we need to look at some additional resources. Like, I think there's a higher level of care that's needed here. And so we were able to do that. He was able to take a small leave and come back after being at a residential unit for a little bit. And when he came back, I remember asking my administration, okay, what do we, like, what's the policy for when students come back from, you know, hospitalization, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, things like that? Like, what are the procedures? And them just saying, we don't really have anything. Like, I mean, you should probably meet with him and you should probably talk about his coping skills and use your counseling skills, but we don't really have a policy or procedure in place.
So what do you do when a student returns from a mental health facility and no one knows what to do next? No policy, no plan, no roadmap, just a kid back in school, holding a new identity and all the stigma that comes with it.
When I think about school counseling and clinical mental health, they have operated in very separate ways, and there are distinctions between the two of them, which I can understand, but I think in that capacity, we had an overlay. Like, we had someone who was coming back from clinical mental health services and they were coming back into the school, and we just didn't have anything in place to support them. And then once that experience happened, and thankfully, you know, I was able to meet with him and we were able to get things adjusted, and I really had to come up with my own way of how to navigate it, essentially, in terms of like confidentiality and making sure that, you know, it was what he wanted to say to teachers and staff about where he was while he was gone and things like that.
That experience, it lit a fire under her. It wasn't just about helping that student. It was about every student who would walk back into a classroom after treatment, after crisis, after surviving something or experiencing something that no one prepared them for. And when no one had a reentry plan, she wrote one.
But it fueled my research agenda down the road too, because that was not the first instance I had something like that. And in both my experience in the school counseling field, but also on the other side of things in the clinical mental health field as a clinician and working with children and adolescents, it was something I was seeing everywhere. We would have kids who would go to, again, like they would be hospitalized or they would go to residential units or they would go to day treatment programs. And there was no reentry plan for when they would come back into school and the best practices or ways to support them. And so after seeing that so much, I decided I was going to develop my own model and develop my own training.
That's awesome.
And test it and use it as my dissertation research. But I think for me, I've always wanted to bridge the gap between the two, because I think school counseling and clinical mental health work so hand in hand with one another. And there's so much potential for them to work in a way that is beneficial for the client and the student. But I think at times we just don't have much in place around it yet. But I do think that's slowly starting to change. But that specific student is always in the back of my head when I think about why I'm a counselor, why I'm here, because it was so impactful. Because you got to think, too, school counselors are talking with the family. So it's, I'm not just working with that one student. I was working with his family. You know, all of us had to sit down and talk about what he had been going through. And I had to, you know, tell his mom, like, hey, I think we need a higher level of care and here are some resources, and just seeing the reactions and trying to help ground people in those moments, because that's a lot of news to hear mm-hmm. at once, especially if, like you were talking about before, if it's something that you weren't aware of mm-hmm. and seeing in your child, it can be a lot to handle at once. So school counselors, I think the common misconception is that they only work with students, and that's just not true. Like, they work with families and parents a lot of times, or caretakers too. And also having to navigate what those interactions look like.
Yeah. So through that thread of acclimation, makes me think about the prison system a little bit. And so having done research on what it would look like to be a successful, transition, mm-hmm. In the prison system, have you ever thought about ways that could apply to the halfway house system or anything like that?
So it's funny you mentioned that, because so I've taken the model and the training I made in my dissertation research. I'm actually working on a study right now with a colleague who's also in counselor education, and also another colleague who is out in the community and has actively worked in the juvenile justice system. But we are now trying to take that model and that training and adapt it for juvenile justice involved youth. So youth that are coming back into schools following, possibly going to like juvenile detention centers or alternative schooling and are now coming back to their home school that they're zoned for and trying to adapt. And what we've seen so far in the study is that it has a lot of the same components as when students are hospitalized and comes back to. So I can imagine that if you're working with adults who are in the justice system, that it probably has some overlap or correlation to some extent.
Yeah. My dad went to prison when I was 10, basically until I was a sophomore in high school. But I remember the halfway house situation very vividly. He got out on Thanksgiving, and I had Thanksgiving at a table in a halfway house. And exactly what you're saying, the emotional toll that people have, first off, leaving a situation like that is emotionally charged to begin with.
Yep.
The treatment you get, it causes a lot of different emotions.
Yeah.
The quality of life you're presented whenever you're released, that creates a lot of emotions, and none of it's cared for. None of it's monitored. It doesn't matter, really. It doesn't. It does, but to those who have any type of enforcement, it does not matter. And I saw a mental decline thereafter of my father. And he was very successful. He owned businesses and things like that after getting out. But mentally, he was just never the same. He just never was the same. And it was just like so apparent to me from that first day he got out. It was just, he was so different than the last day he was in. And it's hard to explain, but I mean, it's a real issue. And again, just hearing you talk about this, things that you've researched, things that can be applied broadly, you know, or at least say, hey, let's approach this situation with this information and see what we find. I think that's great. That's powerful. Mental health isn't only in the eye of people who ask for help or having these outbursts. A lot of times these people don't even know they're having a crisis, but you know where to find them when they are. You know that if you're in a halfway house, you need some care. And there's people out there that can give that to you, or at least you as a doctor or whatever know that they need care. Am I making sense?
No, I think that makes sense. It made me think a lot about too, one of the biggest things that comes up with reentry planning is just the internalized messages you receive from where you went and now coming back. So when I think about from hospitalization, a lot of our students would come back, and if people knew about what happened, they would get these messages of like, oh, like you're crazy and things like that. And no, like that is such negative messaging to put on someone. And also, especially for a child or adolescent to then internalize and carry that with them. And that's not just exclusive to children and adolescents. That happens with adults too, is that we are constantly getting messaging from other people, from society, and we're carrying that with us every day, even though it was something we didn't ask for and we didn't want. So I can imagine too that within the prison system, you also get messaging when you are out and you're, you know, re-entering all of life again and aspects of what life used to be or how you navigate the world where it is now, that there's probably a lot of internal messaging that comes with that as well.
Yeah. Internal and external. Like you said, it's just wild. It's wild to think about how much social work, counseling, mental health fields, how many things touch people in the way that those things are needed. You know, it could be very small and get big. It could be very big and get small. It could stay the same, whatever. But it's just so universal. And that goes back to the question of like, we acknowledge it's universal. When are we going to start treating it like it's universal?
Her focus didn't stop at the school gates. It spilled over into the justice system, community programs, and clinics. because mental health doesn't live in one place, and healing doesn't follow a schedule.
I think in those kind of situations, you're having a lot of feelings all at once. You're having feelings of relief in knowing that, okay, maybe we got to the root of an issue or a concern that's happening, and we at least know maybe what's causing this and how to help in some shape or form. So there's a little bit of relief there. But then I think there's also the anxiety of what is it going to look like moving forward for this person, and knowing that I have to kind of understand where my competency lies and be able to provide them with resources that will give them that higher level of care. And then I think there's...
Competency check-in. So what, I mean, that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people think they're so able, or they can do all these things, yeah, even if they haven't been trained on it. How do you judge yourself? How do you set those limits?
I think the first step in all of that, I think, is being really honest with yourself. I think it's, You want to be confident in what you're doing. You want, because obviously counselors battle imposter syndrome all the time, mm-hmm, and what we're able to do, and, you know, whether or not we're being helpful and all of that. But I think the first step is really being honest with yourself about what you know and what you don't know. And honesty and transparency for me as a counselor goes such a long way with clients. And I will tell them, you know, if I don't know the answer to something, then we will work to find the answer, or I'll find someone who does know the answer. But because I think in the long run, it's so much worse if you lie or you try to take on a situation that you are not competent in, because you're doing a disservice to your client. And in some shape or form, you're causing harm as a counselor. And so I think having that honesty and transparency, and really the key piece too is knowing your network that you have and who you can consult with and who you can reach out to and say, hey, this came up. I'm not really sure how to handle it, but I would love some feedback or guidance. So I think the second piece of that is being open and receptive to receiving constructive feedback. I tell people all the time, I don't always know what I'm doing. That's perfectly fine. Again, like, I'm learning just as much as you are every single day. And I try to be honest with clients about that. And you can be honest with me as a counselor about that too, if there's something I'm doing that, you know, you don't like. And I also will tell them I've worked with 5-year-olds and they've been brutally honest with me. So it's perfectly fine if you want to be brutally honest with me too. So I think those two things just go hand in hand, is being honest with yourself and then being receptive to feedback, because you're not perfect. You, mm-hmm, don't know everything. You're not going to know everything.
Right.
There's lots of gray area in counseling with ethical dilemmas and situations. And so you need to have the ability to consult and reach out to others. During that experience, I think one of the hardest things I had to navigate was when the student came back knowing the experience they had at the facility. And that was because they had a really negative experience that involved a lot of medication management and not as much of a focus on helping learn coping mechanisms. And then it was like, okay, you've been here for X amount of time. Now you're ready to go back to school and be here. And then when they came back, it's like, I don't know what to do. I know I have this diagnosis and I don't understand it. It wasn't explained to me. And that there's a lot of frustration that comes with that as a counselor, because now you're having to help guide them through that, even though you weren't an active part of that experience. And now you're kind of having to deal with the remaining toll it has taken on someone. And so that was just one of the first things we had to address, mm-hmm, when that student came back, was, okay, you were given this diagnosis. Let's explain this in a way that's helpful to understand. It does not mean you're crazy. You can still function on a daily basis. Here are the things we can put in place at the school. So just being really intentional. But there is a lot of frustration sometimes, because obviously you want all the resources and all the agencies in the mental health field, mm-hmm, to be great ones that people recommend. But sometimes people end up at ones that are not so great. And then we have to deal with that.
Yeah. And so with the ones that aren't so great, what? How does that go on? I mean, how do these places get funding? Are they privately owned a lot of times, or what does that look like?
I feel like a lot of times what happens, and I think what's pretty common in the mental health field, both for students who might be hospitalized or pretty much anyone, I feel like everyone can kind of connect to this in some ways, that we see that like white coat syndrome that happens. Or again, people who are in like medical settings are being told what they need and being told what to do around things. But sometimes it's, especially for children, adolescents, it's not often explained in a way that's helpful or concrete to them. Mm-hmm. And it can get really fusing. And then it feeds into those internalized messages like we were talking about before. And so I think that's where counseling differs, is that we're taking the time to explain it. We are working with a client, not for a client.
Yes, yes. Okay. So, and then back to him, or do they identify as
he? Yeah, okay. He used he, him pronouns.
So he gets back and he is seeing the same faces, the same walls, the same surroundings, mm-hmm. and has learned something new about himself, but in a vulnerable age,
yeah.
in a way, has to apply those, that new self
yep.
in that old place. Mm-hmm. And that feels very unsustainable.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
I think just difficult. I mean, it's when you're working with students that age too, the biggest thing in their life is identity development. And so having to come back and hear messaging, having a label that's been put on them, having to navigate what that looks like and what that even means. And then also having like social networks are so big during that time too, because you're trying to figure out who you are as a person, but then you're also in these groups of social networks mm-hmm. and having to navigate who your friends are and how you want them to view you. And so I think it's just really challenging. It just adds another layer of complexity to all yeah. of it. Like what we would see as like traditional child development
plus a public development
yeah.
aspect, because this isn't now, it's been taken away. Now people are curious.
Yep.
You're probably answering questions because you're a child and don't know you have boundaries that you can respect.
Yep.
So that's so much. Mm-hmm. That is so much. And then you on the other side are watching this.
Yep.
And you can't help this child but so much, mm-hmm. but you want what's best for them and to see them thrive, but you can't control them.
Yeah.
What is it like to go home at night and feel that?
I think it's challenging because you are doing everything in your power to try and help. And I think that was where I had to teach myself that there are things that are outside of my control that I cannot do anything about. Like I had to remember my like inner locus of control and what I can do at the school that can make their experience better and that can be helpful and beneficial to where they're at and meeting their needs. But also reminding myself there's only so much I can do as a counselor, and then I have to find resources, or I have to know where that's just outside of my control and I can't do anything about it. So I think that's another really challenging piece to counseling as a whole too, is just navigating what you can and can't control. But I think that's also like a life lesson everyone yeah. kind of navigates as they grow up too. So,
and counselors need counselors. That's a thing.
Yep. Yes. I always say that to everyone.
So whenever you're dealing with these things, they've got tools like dialectical behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. Do you use anything like that?
So I like acceptance and commitment therapy. It's called ACT. And I like narrative therapy, which I come from a generation of storytellers. So narrative therapy was a really natural fit for me because it ties in the client's lived experiences through stories and being able to identify themes and like, it's very metaphorical, but the main characters within your life and your story and reauthoring your story in a way that is meeting the goals you have for counseling too, and where you envision yourself.
So how does that, you're dealing with this specific situation. Mm-hmm. How would you use that in that scenario?
So in that situation, we really had to break down a lot of the experience of what happens leaving school and coming back and kind of identifying like again, it's very metaphorical, but identifying where the plot thickened to some extent and who was involved, and then coming back and reauthoring a story of what they wanted to tell other people, what they wanted to envision the remainder of their school year to look like, and the goals they had for counseling. So we kind of focused it in that sense with narrative. And I think with ACT, ACT is great for helping address internalized messages, because one of the parts of ACT is that bad things are going to happen to you, or you're going to get negative messages in life, and you need to be able to acknowledge them and acknowledge the impact they had on you and how they make you feel. But also you have the ability and the autonomy to let go of them. So how do you move on from those messages? And so I think those two theoretical frameworks working hand in hand were just ideal for that situation and where his needs were at the time.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome. I've never heard of either of those.
Oh, okay.
But I'm going to use
them. They're great. I highly recommend anyone looking into them.
I'm deep into the mindfulness rabbit hole right now with dialectical behavioral therapy. I've done a little bit of cognitive, but just trying to find those tools that work, you know, and that's just a whole other thing. But and tools don't work for everybody all the time. There's not a tool that works for everyone all the time. But I think that's a big part of this, too, is like helping people find tools that do work and practice them now. Mm-hmm. Don't practice them when you need them, because practice them when you do that. That's another layer. You're learning something in the time that you need it, you know? Yeah. And that's something I really want to drive home with this podcast as well, is, you know, find your tools, listen to these folks who are sharing what worked for them. Mm-hmm. Work on them now. Find a way to incorporate them into your life, even if it's in small ways, and it will pay off so big whenever you get into the field.
Narrative therapy and ACT, or ACT, these weren't just tools she used. They were ways to let her clients hold the pen again. Because sometimes healing doesn't start with advice. It starts with a new story. And sometimes the best things we can do is just let someone tell it.
So we talked a lot about the tools that you used to get through this. Clearly you were able to adapt and change to the situation, kind of. You were, in a way, you were changing the environment for this student, and in that you had to exist within the environment that you changed. And there is a lot to be done in learning how to do that. But there's also a lot to be done in learning how to walk away from that.
Yeah.
So what did you learn in that experience?
I feel like that experience taught me, well, one, I think it encouraged me in my skills and ability of what I could do as a counselor. And it taught me that you can navigate a system that, you know, is not perfect, may not be made for the student, but you can navigate it in a way that will still benefit them and still provide them, or help promote well-being is probably the better way to say it. Because it can be really challenging when you're working in systems that were not made for you, and it can feel really frustrating and knowing that there are things outside of your control. So I think the biggest thing it taught me was that I understood in those moments how to navigate the system I was in, but also highlight the needs of the student I was working with in a way that was beneficial to their environment.
So making it so it's beneficial, but something you can maintain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a balancing act.
Yeah.
And for you to, I guess the balancing act in itself is a big thing. And so my question from that would be, do you find yourself struggling to keep balance within situations, you know, not balance with work life, whatever, you know, that's something that just you accept it as soon as you click apply on the college application. You'll never have a work life balance. But as far as that balance within these types of situations, is that something that you continue to strive for? Have you found a good way to strike a balance?
I think the most helpful reminder for me in navigating systems and maintaining that balance is knowing that, or understanding the fact that you can't go into a system completely challenging it and expecting it to change overnight. There are subtle ways to advocate within systems that can still be beneficial and help promote the needs of the community without directly having to challenge it and put your job at risk, put your education at risk. And so you have to learn how to work within the system that you're in.
Yeah.
And I think that is something I see with a lot of counselors who are early in their careers that they really struggle with, especially I think school counselors, just because you have to learn to work within the school district policies and what you can and can't do. But there are ways that you can advocate for students and very subtle moves and conversations and things that you're doing within the school environment that show people, hey, I'm here to support you. And maybe I don't fully agree with this, but that's you know, we're working on the battle, not the war right now kind of deal. There are changes you can make that don't need to be like blown into full on issues or concerns that are being directly brought
up. So in a way, finding a way to illustrate the macro vision so that people understand what you're actually working on within that bigger picture type.
Yeah. And I think if we think about like in from an ecological systems framework, like that makes sense too, because you have to start with the microsystem before you can work your way out through the mesosystem, exosystem, chronosystem, like the larger systemic barriers that we have. You have to start first with the microsystem at play and not just jump straight to the outer level thinking you can make those changes. Like there are ways you can do that within each level, but you have to work your way through it.
Right. To make it sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Balance. And we've talked a lot about your balancing act, your personal care. And there's more to a situation than being in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of what I'm hearing from you.
Mm-hmm.
How does that influence how you work with clients now, leaving that situation?
I think it influences in a way of never trying to make assumptions about what I know about a client and really asking them. I think that's the biggest, that's also the biggest supervision guidance I've ever given to counselors that have I've worked with, is when they come and ask questions, and I've had these questions in my experience too, where I'm like, should I go this route and do this intervention or maybe try this because I do think this could be beneficial? One of the best things that someone ever told me was, well, did you ask the client? Like, did you take a step back and ask the client what they thought around that? And I think it really makes people pause, because we can get so caught up in learning the material, you know, trying to gain expertise. But sometimes we really do have to sit back and just ask the client, hey, what do you think about this and us trying this moving forward? What do you think about this coping mechanism that maybe we can try in session? Or where do you feel like you would like your counseling journey to go? Like, what are the goals that you want to make? And so a part of that, I think, is giving the autonomy back to the client, which is in that situation I was trying to do with the student, is really giving them the space and the power in those sessions, because that was not something they were getting when they got in that experience, but also in a school setting.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really getting power in certain situations. So I really tried to give them that autonomy back so that they had control over how the sessions would go and what they wanted it to look like.
Yeah. So it's also easy to think that whenever you're going to help someone and you are the professional that is trying to help this person, I think this is a subconscious thing. But a lot of times it's easy to think that, well, they need the help and I have the know-how and I'm here to help. I'm very eager to give these answers because I know what to do to help, right? So subconsciously, we're not trying to take autonomy away from people, but we're also trying to fix this as quickly as we can because we want to see this person get better. And a lot of, and it was just something I heard of what you were saying was, you know, that's part of the problem is that we're not giving autonomy, and that keeps us really, it slows progress because you're going to try something that's not going to work for that individual. And so you're going to get frustrated and it's going to become a bigger issue than if you just had a conversation to try to kind of let that client help you steer a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that what's coming to my mind now too is that we have to be careful and mindful about our tendencies as counselors to want to fix things and to provide solutions, because what messaging is that telling to our client? One, it's saying you're broken and you need to be fixed, but also it's restricting that autonomy around, I know what's best, I know what we can do. And it's further perpetuating that white coat syndrome that they experience maybe in other, like the medical field and other areas of their life where they don't have that power in the situation. So I think we have to be mindful that we don't want to add on to the internalized messages that they're already receiving.
Yeah. Like, I'm broken because these things aren't helping. Yeah. I mean, that's huge too. I didn't even think about that. That's, man. So would you agree that in a way that kind of perpetuates the mental health crises that we're having, is that a lack of these conversations are leading to escalated situations?
Possibly. I think there's a lot of different factors that can perpetuate mental health crises. And I think it boils down to where the client is at and what they're being told, but also what their previous experiences are like with, it doesn't even have to be anything related to the health field, like what your previous experiences are like working with authority figures or people that you view as authority figures. Because there is, when you think about counseling and in the space, there is a power differential that inherently happens in counseling. And so that's one of the things we teach our students. You have to really be mindful about, even if you don't feel like you have the power in the space, it's inherently there because you're in a therapeutic relationship with someone who is viewing you for is wanting to see you give guidance. And so you really have to navigate and kind of work through that balance of wanting to give autonomy back, but also providing the psychoeducation when it's needed, or maybe giving some of that guidance as it's needed. So I think that there is a piece to it around that. I also think, and I could get on a soapbox about this, but I think I think, and this is very much, if you ask anyone, I think in our department or in the mental health field, they'll tell you that self-care is a trigger word now for a lot of people. And I think it's because as a society, people have capitalized on it and have taken self-care to be something that is now more with consumerism and not really about intentionality and well-being. And so I think there's that aspect too of, like, we're trying to reduce the stigma, but also we're taking, you know, like positive psychology terms and we're transforming them into ways that we're able to sell products and things like that. And it's furthering the purpose of what it actually was intended for. And so I tell people all the time, self-care was intended to be intentional for you. It's not always about treating yourself and going and buying something. It's more of a
retail
practice.
Therapy.
Yeah. It's more of a practice of something you engage in that's going to make you feel better and promote well-being. And I think the other piece to that too is what we see when that happens with, I think, specific skills or interventions that are used. The other example that comes to mind is affirmations. I can't tell you how many clients I've had and how many students I've had who will say, I tried affirmations, they just don't work for me. And I'll ask them, okay, well, when we think about the statements you were saying, did you believe in them at all? Like, was there even a little ounce of you that believed in what you were putting into those statements? And they'll say, no, I just kind of use generic statements. And I'll tell them, well, that's why. I said, if you're just saying empty statements to yourself in a mirror, that's not going to be helpful for you. Like, the research shows that with affirmations, you have to believe in them in the slightest. Because if you don't, then it's not registering in your mind that it's an intentional practice for you.
It's like a foot in the door. Like,
yeah.
You're just trying to open that door. We just got to have a little bit of truth in it for it to work. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Would you agree that whenever you're a practicing counselor, that it would be beneficial? Obviously, you know, if you're working with addiction, you know, you're going to kind of silo in that way. Would you recommend people also subscribing to some sort of study within that? So, like specific, you know, you're not just throwing spaghetti at a wall. You're mastering these specific skills that you're teaching. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, you know, this is what I do. And if it doesn't work for you, I'm going to refer you to someone else. But if this works for you, I am going to do the best I can to help you. Would you agree that that's the way to go, or
you, a part of counseling is finding a counselor that fits with the client. And so sometimes, and we say this in the mental health field, is sometimes you kind of have to shop around for counselors. And so, but that's the piece that I think sometimes that can promote the barriers or the challenges, is that someone will have a bad experience with a counselor because of maybe the interventions they were trying to use with that person, but it's not explained to them of, maybe that person just wasn't the right fit for you. Mm-hmm. Like, not everyone is going to be your cup of tea. That's perfectly fine.
And that goes back to what you were saying earlier. Yeah. So these people have these inner dialogues that they were, you know, introduced to something that doesn't work because they didn't have a conversation first. Yeah. So the responsibility of the counselor then is to actually have that conversation. So this is private practice we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about school counselors or anything like that. But in private practice, there is that responsibility to have that conversation when someone comes in and say, hey, this is an interview. We are going to get to know each other and we need to make sure this is going to work because I don't want you to spend a lot of time here if it's not. That said, I might have someone that can work with you and get you the results you want.
Yeah.
And also back to what you're saying, you know, you've got the retail therapy and all these things that are capitalizing on the idea of mental health. Unfortunately, we also have counselors that are in that same vein saying, come to me, I will fix you no matter what's wrong. And people don't realize that there are a lot of specialties out there, EMDR and whatever you need. Talk therapy doesn't work for everybody.
Yep.
And that's such a big thing that I think you are touching on from, like you said, the experience where the inner dialogue of someone who's kind of in a state system or what have you to now the private practice, and again, how that may perpetuate issues further.
We don't always think about what it means to sit in that counseling chair, what it costs to care, the emotional toll of seeing someone fall through the cracks, or watching a student come back changed, unsure, and overwhelmed. And what's harder, knowing you can't fix it? You can guide, you can support, you can advocate, but you can't control the system. You can't undo the harm. And that can stay with you. But Alex, she didn't stop showing up.
I would tell people to trust in the process of getting there, and that who you are meant to be, you will be. Like, to trust in the process, hone in on your skills, know your competency, be open to any opportunity that comes your way. That was the biggest thing for me in my academic experience, was just taking any opportunity I could to learn more about the field, to engage with people, to better understand the human connection that we have with one another. And so I think that's just a really important piece, is just trusting the process and taking opportunities as they come up, and Always being yourself. Never feel like you have to be someone else or put on a counselor demeanor or personality, but truly it's that genuine connection is going to come from you being who you are.
The most powerful thing she said to me wasn't about a diagnosis or a theory. It was about autonomy and the damage we do when we try to fix someone instead of walk with them. You can hear it in the way she gives power back to her clients. How she slows down long enough to ask them, "What do you think?" And that's the message worth holding on to. That even in the middle of systems we can't control, even when the stigma feels too heavy to move, there's still space for honesty, there's space for curiosity, and there's even space for connection. Maybe that's where the healing begins, and maybe that's what shaped her most of all. Thank you for joining me. This was From the Field with Tanner. Remember to be kind to yourself, and that everyone is doing the best they can all of the time.